Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. The 2004 Emerald Awards for Environmental Excellence have been announced, and among the many exciting nominations were several dealing with research and innovation. These projects will help industry and communities lessen their environmental footprint. Dr. Brad Stelfox developed the ALCES computer model to help us track and predict cumulative impacts on the landscape. Dr. Ray Krause used stable isotope techniques to analyze sulfur pollution. Don Publubny and his crew at the Foothills Model Forest followed grizzly bears to determine better planning methods for industry. And Dr. Gordon McKinnon at Syncrude engineered an instrumented watershed approach to monitor landscape reclamation. And on the humanitarian front, Professor Dave Irvin Halliday from the University of Calgary is lighting up the world with light-emitting diodes and pedal power. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. The 13th Annual Emerald Awards for Environmental Excellence celebrated yet another round of amazing efforts on the part of Albertans to do something better for our environment. I had a chance before the awards to briefly speak with the four nominees in the category for research and innovation. Dr. Roy Krause is a professor emeritus at the University of Calgary. His work with tracking sulfur in the environment has led to worldwide recognition for the techniques he developed.
I adapted techniques that were known in geochemistry, namely stable isotope methodology, to identify sources of sulfur in the environment. Being able to say that so much of that sulfur came from industry, so much of that sulfur has been there for eons over geological ages, and so on.
What has been the benefit of this?
Well, I have had interactions with people in situations where traditional chemical analysis led to the wrong conclusions. Just because sulfur concentrations may have been high in vegetation or soil, it was blamed on industry. And there are instances when I found that the industry was entirely innocent. There were other situations where, in fact, on the basis of our isotope techniques, we could say, hey, over 90% of the sulfur in the environment has come from the industrial emissions. So you might say that we've used stable isotope methodology as a tool to establish the truth.
How significant is sulfur pollution in the Alberta environment?
In environments close to gas plants, you may see significant damage. In some parts of the province, the emissions have actually provided sulfur where the soil was sulfur poor. So in a way, the emissions have been good, and in other situations, they have been bad. But I think one should look worldwide at situations that are far worse than what we have here in Alberta, where, for example, salmon populations have been wiped out because the eggs simply wouldn't hatch because of acidic sulfur, acidic waters in which they used to live. So it's had local as well as international significance.
What challenges did you face when you were first starting out to do this investigation?
Well, people associated isotopes with something radioactive. These are stable isotopes. It was a matter, actually, of gaining the confidence of industry, of colleagues in Alberta Environment, and so on. And it required two or three test situations where we were able to come up with the correct answers. And once we did that, then people started to come to us. And people internationally came to us. And the United Nations Environmental Program called upon me for services. And the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna. So once we had a few good studies things started to happen on their own. We became in demand.
How is it that you got your samples?
That was part of our innovation, deciding what to sample and how to sample. And one thing we're expert on is better resolved sampling. Don't look at just the total sulfur in the air. Look at sulfur dioxide gas. Don't just look at particulate matter. Put your samples under an electron microscope and you see that some of the solids are plant residues. Some might be sand blown from very distant locations. Some might be gypsum particles that have come in from long distance travel. So I think this has been part of the secret. Looking at the total environment, we like to put together isotope patterns going from deep in the ground up to the atmosphere.
Thank you very much, and congratulations.
Okay, thank you.
That was Dr. Roy Krause, Professor Emeritus in Physics at the University of Calgary. A second finalist for the Emerald Award in Research and Innovation was Syncrude Canada. Dr. Gordon McKinnon is the geotechnical engineer in charge of Syncrude's research on instrumented watersheds for land reclamation.
Well, Syncrude's been working for the past 5 years on developing instrumented watersheds for reclamation research. The work involves taking areas of land and that have been recently reclaimed after oil sands mining. And the reclamation involves placing soil and planting trees and bushes. We take those areas, and with the work through the universities, the University of Alberta and University of Saskatchewan, plus four or five other universities across Canada, we've instrumented those to track the water and any salts in the soils, the heat from the sunlight, and the vegetation growth and the animals in the area and how they use the site, and bring that all together to understand better how our landscapes are performing and how we might change our practices to make them even better in the future.
Now, you call this an instrumented watershed. What kind of instruments do you use?
Probably the major instrument that's out there is a climate station, similar to what Environment Canada would use. In fact, we work with them on this. And so we're measuring the amount of snowfall, the amount of snowpack, rainfall, the amount of the temperature, the wind speed, and humidity in that. And from that, we know how much water is falling onto the landscape. Then some of it runs off. We have weirs that measure the amount of water and the temperature of the water that flows off the landscape. Then we've got a lot of sensors within the soil that measure how much water is percolating down into the soil and how much the plants are using, taking it back out. So in the end, we should be able to track all the water coming in, all the water going out, and all the water being used by the plants.
Trying to reclaim a land site once it's been mined, whether it's for oil sands or any other kind of commercial or industrial development, is really a very challenging thing. What are some of the problems that you've found?
The challenge, I think, first of all, is one of scale. And it's about 200 square kilometers that Syncrude will disturb at its Mildred Lake mine site north of Fort McMurray. And the scale of that and making sure that the whole landscape works well together, that the water falling on the landscape makes its way to channels and through the lakes and back to the Athabasca River safely without erosion, and that the lakes and wetlands and that are self-sustaining. So the challenge is partly one of scale. The other one is that it's a new endeavor dealing with the landscape this size. It's about the size of a quarter of the city of Edmonton. And we're building a landscape that has to last for thousands of years. And so the challenge then is doing that at that scale and largely unprecedented at that scale. And that's why we're investing so much effort in making sure that we understand the best ways of doing it and doing it right the first time.
What are some of the things that you've found out with this project?
Probably the main thing is that the amount of cover soil that we're placing, which in the one in particular is a meter of material that goes over the overburden that we pile up in advance of mining, that meter, which was chosen about 20 years ago based on the best judgment of the day, is proving to be about the right depth. We've tried some thicker and some thinner, and the the right water balance and the right conditions for the plant seem to be at that meter. So in one sense, it's not new information that it's confirmed. But from that, then the other things we're learning is that most of the water, about 80 or 85% of the water that lands on the landscape, is used by the plants and evaporates and transpirates back out of the system. A little bit runs off that we collect and feed through wetlands, and a little bit seeps into the ground. But for an engineer on the project, and I think a lot of our soil scientists and vegetation people knew this well, but the amount of water that's used by the plants and used usefully is stunning.
Will this continue?
Yeah, the work, we've got three watersheds right now, each in a different area of the mine on different substrates. And each of them goes through about a 5 or 6 year phase, two phases, 3 years each. And our first watershed is ending its second phase. Our second watershed is entering its second phase. And one is just beginning. And there's four or five more to come over the next while. And even once they're finished, we'll continue to monitor some of the instruments for decades to come and use that to learn more over time and how these landscapes change over the next 50 or 100 years.
Thank you very much, Gordon.
Thanks.
That was Dr. Gordon MacKinnon, a senior geotechnical engineer with Syncrude Canada. One person who's had a tremendous influence on changing industrial practices in relation to environmental impact is Dr. Brad Stelfox. A biologist by training, Brad has seen firsthand the cumulative impacts development has had on wildlife habitat. Foresters, seismic companies, oil sands executives, just about everyone in these industries now speaks the language that Brad has taught them about cumulative effects. At this year's Emerald Awards for Environmental Excellence, Brad was honored for the work he did developing the ALCES computer model.
Well, ALCES is a computer-based simulation model that helps Albertans keep track of land use practices and understand how land uses affect transformations of landscapes and generate jobs and revenues and flows of various commodities like wood, water, fiber, agricultural products, but also look at some of the challenges it causes to the environment in terms of water use or wildlife habitat.
You've been going at this now for a few years. How has ALCES and the use of ALCES grown?
Well, ALCES as a model has been around now for about 7 years, and what we're seeing is kind of incremental acceptance of the need for some sort of massive calculator that keeps track of all the land use practices that are transforming Alberta. So I think at the corporate level and in terms of many governmental departments that we're seeing gradual acceptance of the model and a need for keeping track of land use practices.
What are some of the things that you found that have been really striking as you've developed the program and it's been accepted?
Well, much around the concept of what I call meaningful time. A lot of these landscapes are not being rewritten overnight. In fact, much of Alberta is being changed at a rate of 2% a year. And as humans, we find it challenging to observe that 2% a year rate. So what ALCES helps people realize is that over 20 or 30 years, major, substantial changes can occur in terms of the amount of natural habitat or the amount of production of commodities from land use. But on an individual by individual year basis, it's often difficult to even see that change.
What does it mean to you being a finalist for an Emerald Award?
Well, I'm very proud that someone nominated the ALCES model, and it's a reflection of 30 or 40 people from government and industry and academia that have been working on this concept for several years. So it's a favorable reflection on a lot of hard work by a lot of people, so I'm quite pleased.
Thank you very much, Brad.
You're welcome, Cheryl.
That was Dr. Brad Stelfox of Forum Technologies, first recipient of the Emerald Award in the Research and Innovation category. The second Emerald Award in Research and Innovation went to the Foothills Model Forest for its grizzly bear research program. Don Publubny is the general manager for the Foothills Model Forest.
The project looks at grizzly bears, their habitat, and their movements. The project was started in 1999 because of concern on the grizzly bear populations in Alberta, and our program looks at those aspects and involves a number of universities across Western Canada and the United States.
How was the program set up?
The program is set up to look at, we initially started in the Foothills Model Forest area, which comprises 2.75 million hectares of study area. And we looked at the movements of grizzly bears in Jasper National Park compared to outside of Jasper. Then we looked at the habitat and vegetation the bears use, and then we compared the two studies and tried to see how we could predict movement of bears.
Why did you look at bears? Why grizzly bears?
Grizzly bears are considered an umbrella species. At one time, they covered most of North America, all the way down to Mexico. And now you find them in the remoter areas along the Rocky Mountains. So we find that if the grizzly bears move out, you'll have some environmental problems coming. So we're quite concerned on the movement of the grizzly bears, the habitat for them, and how we can work industry and the grizzly bears together.
This has been going on for 5 years. What have you found?
We found that the grizzly bears are doing not too bad. The habitat created by disturbance from industry is working for the benefit of the grizzly bears. There are problems with access, and we find that there's difference in the species between national parks and outside the national parks.
Where do you go from here?
Right now, what we're looking at is creating a database that we can create habitat maps from Grand Prairie all the way down to the United States border along the eastern Rocky Mountains. We then provide that information to the industry, both oil and gas and the timber industry, that they can use the information to plot cut blocks, roads, pipelines, access, and hopefully improve the habitat for the grizzly bear and mitigate any disturbances to prime habitat that they are using.
Who's been supporting this through the Models Forest?
Well, this is supported by the federal government, the provincial government, oil and gas industry, the timber industry, a number of timber companies. We have support from the World Wildlife Fund and a number of other agencies.
Thank you very much, Don.
Thank you.
That was Don Poblubny, General Manager of the Foothills Model Forest. The Grizzly Bear Research Program received the second Emerald Award in the Research and Innovation category. I also spoke with Dr. Brad Stelfox, Dr. Gordon McKinnon, and Dr. Roy Krause. The Emerald Awards for Environmental Excellence also recognizes the work of not-for-profit associations. For several years, Dr. Dave Irvin Halliday has been traveling the villages of the Third World, quite literally lighting up the world of thousands of people who have no access to electricity or modern conveniences. This University of Calgary engineering professor has adapted LED technology, turning it into simple, non-polluting, cost-effective devices that these villagers can use. And the potential for reducing greenhouse gas emissions is enormous.
Light of the World provides lighting to developing world homes. And the source of lighting, or the lamp as we call it, is based on white light-emitting diodes. Just the same device basically as you have on your computers and all these little blinking lights, except these are the kind of turbo models. They just produce a lot more light.
Is this something that you've put together yourself?
Light of the World is not responsible for the invention of the LED. I think if we're due any credit, the credit must be for recognizing the fact that you could apply what is now called solid-state lighting, in other words, light-emitting diode-type lighting, to the developing world. I think there's no question. We were the first to appreciate that it could be done, and we did do it, and we are the world leaders in bringing solid-state lighting to the developing world.
Tell me what it's like. What's the scenario for the people in these developing countries where they require what it is that you have?
In the developing world, very largely, the homes are in almost complete darkness once the sun goes down. And if you know anything about your geography, you'll appreciate that when you're fairly close to the equator, 12 months a year, it's dark by 6:30 p.m. So any decent form of lighting is just a godsend to these people. And that's, in fact, what we're helping to facilitate. With 1 or 2 watts per home, we're literally changing their lives.
If the people weren't using your light-emitting diode, what would they be using?
What the solid-state lighting or the light-emitting diode lights that we're using, what they're replacing is anything between ranging from simple twigs, burning twigs and sap. Much of the population use these smoky, dangerous kerosene wick lamps, and some of them might have some simple form of electric lighting if they're really, really, really lucky. But mostly it's kerosene and twigs.
You're here tonight at the Emerald Awards celebration. Your work has been recognized, and you have received the Emerald Award. What impact does this have from an environmental perspective?
One of the great things about solid-state lighting is the fact that it's affordable by many of these 2 billion people. Now, if you think of the amount of CO2, etc., that's generated by all these millions of barrels of equivalent, I suppose, of kerosene that's burned. By replacing these, you know, there's an enormous positive effect on the environment. We're actually looking very seriously at trying to claim carbon credits, because if we could claim carbon credits for lighting millions of homes eventually, then it means it gives us funds to light even more homes.
Do you see something like this being used in Canada?
There's no question that the overdeveloped world will one of these days recognize the fact that solid-state lighting is a real boon for us as well. A number of years ago, I did a wee calculation for a reporter in Calgary, and I said to him, I reckon I could light your house up to a very acceptable degree using the white light-emitting diodes at that time, which are not as good as they are now. And I said, and your annual bill for electricity would be maximum $20. Right now, the average bill for electricity for lighting, I must confess, for lighting in Calgary, well, at least a couple of years ago, it was $184. So it was like a 10-to-1 reduction in energy use. If you could do that right across the province, you could save an awful lot of energy, which means you wouldn't have to build more power stations for quite a while.
What do the lights actually look like?
Well, the lamps themselves, the body of the lamp can have any shape, you know. But the diode itself is fairly similar, regardless of whether it's what we call a 0.1-watt diode or a 1-watt diode. But they just look like if you just imagine a little hemisphere, which is about 5 millimeters or about a quarter of an inch diameter and, you know, about a quarter of an inch high. I mean, they just look like a little dome. In actual fact, they're solid. They're not hollow like a glass bulb. And the fact that they're solid, that's one of the reasons that they're virtually unbreakable.
And do they switch on and off?
Yeah, the LED is a DC device. In other words, it uses like a battery. It doesn't use alternating current. And if people are observant, they'll notice that the rear lights in many cars are now using them, especially the brake lights, signaling lights, lights for crossing, you know, at crosswalks and traffic lights, because they switch on and off much quicker than an incandescent. They live for decades as opposed to, you know, a year or so, and they're much more energy efficient. So all told, you it's kind of a win-win-win-win-win situation by, you know, converting to solid-state lighting.
So if they run off a battery, how do you recharge it? Where does the energy actually come from?
In our case, talking about the developing world, the energy comes from a number of sources. Of the 4,000 plus homes that we've lit to date, the about 85% of the energy source is a small solar panel, which charges up a battery, and then the battery powers the lamps at night. But we've also used small, what we call pico, like very small hydro units, ranging from 200 watts to 1,000 watts. And we've used literally human pedal power, where half an hour gentle pedaling, you know, in the morning tops up the battery from the 4 hours of use or so the night before. So it's not arduous work. And not only that, you can charge up to a half a dozen batteries simultaneously on the same little kind of pedal generator.
You get your exercise at the same time.
Well, to be quite honest, the people in the developing world don't need any more exercise. But it was our first attempt to light villages, and because my wife Jenny and I were paying for everything, it was actually a much cheaper option for us than solar panels. But solar panels are definitely the way to go, because you just put them up and they do their work for 20 years or so, and they need virtually no maintenance. You just have to keep them relatively clean.
Why are you doing this?
The reason I'm doing it, I have no idea in a sense, because it just came to me in 1997 to see if I could help the people in Nepal where I was trekking at the time. Once I made the first lamps and realized that, like Eureka, with a 0.1 watt LED, you could read a book. Therefore, with a 1 watt lamp, you could light a small room. And it literally has taken over our lives. And we're not complaining, because there's so much good that you can do for so many people in such a short time and at a relatively modest cost. I mean, it's a gift from God for these people, and it's really a privilege for us to be allowed to be in a position to help so many people. It's just fantastic.
What is your background?
My background, officially, apart from being a full professor at the University of Calgary, for the last 25 years or more, I suppose, I've been what you might call a fiber optic research specialist, biophotonics, photonics. But about a year ago, I literally gave up all of my... I didn't forget all I'd ever done, but I no longer do any work in fiber optics. All my grad students, all the courses that I'll be teaching in the future years will all be to do with the light up the world, the developing world, renewable energy, sustainable energy. We're having a ball.
Thank you very much, and congratulations.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Dave Irvin Halliday, professor of engineering at the University of Calgary and founder of Light Up the World Foundation. Not only was his humanitarian work recognized at the recent Emerald Awards celebration for environmental excellence, he has also just been named by Reader's Digest as their Hero of the Year. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, Alberta Research Council, Science Alberta Foundation, the University of Lethbridge, Alberta Ingenuity, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Ducks Unlimited Canada, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, and the Alberta Conservation Association. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.